Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This is just one segment of today's show. You can hear all of our conversations about New York's vibrant cultural scene on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. Today, we continue our Mozart 250 week-long look at Mozart and his legacy. Today, Mozart candies and sausages. We'll also have a live performance of some unusual interpretations of Mozart's work by the group The Four Bags. But first, this story. The latest medium for upcoming musicians is the realm of primetime comedy. CBS launched last week a show called Love Monkey, a sitcom about a record label talent scout played by Tom Cavanaugh and his pursuit of an ideal music industry and a stable love life. So, does the music business make for a good TV show? Here with his opinion is Adam Sternberg, who writes about TV for New York Magazine. Adam, first of all, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, now, you wrote in your article that Love Monkey is Sex in the City for guys. And actually, I've seen that reference made in one or two other reviews as well. Do you think it works?
The show or the
concept of trying to take, you know, the Sex and the City mode and sort of turning it, you know, gender-wise towards guys?
I think it can work. I don't think they've quite got the formula down pat on Love Monkey, partly because the show feels a little bit schizophrenic. Now that it's two episodes into the season, it can't seem to quite decide if it wants to be a show about modern dating in New York, or if it wants to be a show about the music industry, or I guess ideally combine those two things, although they're kind of hard to weave together.
Right. Now, I mean, in the first episode, there is an awful lot about the music industry. You know, the guy he's working, he's an A&R, a talent scout for a major record label, Goliath Records, gets fired, ends up joining a kind of a hip indie rock label at the end of the show. The romance that falls apart in mid-show seems almost besides the point. I didn't see the second episode. Are you saying that maybe the kind of the romantic interest is played up a bit more in the second episode?
Well, at the end of the first episode, he winds up sort of getting saved by getting a job at a very kind of reputable, credible indie label. And, of course, there's a beautiful woman who worked there who also has great musical taste, which, you know, to the main character of the show is kind of the holy grail. So I think there's some suggestion that there'll be a kind of ongoing intrigue between the two of them. He's also got this kind of Greek chorus of buddies who hang out with him and play basketball and kind of talk about, you know, guy problems.
Right.
With varying degrees of humor.
So why do you suppose they chose the music industry? The original book, as I understand, was about a newspaper or some form of print.
Yeah, the show is based on a novel of the same name, Love Monkey, by a guy named Kyle Smith, who was, I believe, a film critic at the New York Post. But the character in the book was a journalist. And in converting it to TV, I think there was two sort of streams of thinking. One was, you know, it's not that interesting to watch journalists sit around. It's a lot more fun to have a guy who can go out to concerts and have a musical element to the show. But also, I think, you know, the show was sort of designed around this relatively new idea that TV shows can be a great way to launch bands and to get people to introduce them to new music. It's something that, you know, the TV show The OC has turned out to be incredibly influential in terms of, you know, the producers of the show going out, finding music that they like, or, you know, now, of course, everyone's clamoring to get on the show. playing the music on the show, then releasing it in these compilation albums, and really, you know, making the careers of bands that previously, you know, very few people in the mainstream had heard of, bands like Death Cab for Cutie and things like that. And I think Love Monkey wants to become a similar kind of show.
Right. All right, let's hear a little excerpt from the most recent episode. This was this week on Tuesday. Here, Tom is talking to a pop artist named Zoe, who is from his old record label, from Goliath Records. And because of a big benefit thing that they're doing, that they're trying to do together, she wants to do some of her own material instead of the kind of pop stuff that she's become famous for. And she's just played some of her own material for Tom and wants to know what he thinks about it.
So what'd you think?
I thought it was different, you know, from what you normally do, like a departure. It was unique, but I thought...
You hated it.
No.
I know the guitar playing needs some help.
Don't worry about the guitar playing. You know, it takes some artists years to hone their acoustic skills. You're more polished in other ways, but the thing is, we don't have years, you know, the benefits in a day. So I was thinking maybe another song from the album. You know what I was thinking is that song, Break My Teenage Heart. You know, I really like that song, you know, Break My Teenage Heart. Now that we're apart, I feel like Jean Paul Sartre, only maybe not so smart. Smart?
You don't care what I want or about my music, do you? You're just trying to get me to do what you want, a big fat pop song. You know, this whole I'm a cool A&R guy is just another part of your shtick.
Zoe, that's just not true.
You're just another suit.
All right, that's a little bit from the CBS sitcom Love Monkey, and we're speaking with Adam Sternberg, senior editor for New York Magazine, writes about TV, has written about Love Monkey. There's a lot of this kind of art versus commerce as a major plot device throughout the series so far. Is this likely to be a kind of a tell-all book inside the music industry?
Well, there's a kind of inbuilt irony to the show that some sort of observers on the internet are already picking up on, which is that, you know, on the show, the main character, Tom, goes through a lot of soul searching about, you know, being true to his roots and finding bands that are just about the music and turning his back on this glitzy world of marketing and promotion as represented by his sort of unsubtly named former employer, Goliath Records. And yet the show itself is in essence designed as a kind of marketing platform for new bands. And in fact, there is a character on the first couple of episodes who on the show is called Wayne, who in real life is a young musician named Teddy Geiger, who is signed to Sony. And Sony and CBS have a deal that, you know, if the show continues, that Sony artists will appear on the show as the musicians that, you know, Tom sort of discovers. So basically, even as his character is talking about kind of staying true to his roots and finding great bands, what he's actually doing is, he's sort of a de facto, you know, spokesperson for Sony Records.
Right. So this has become, as you say, basically, it's a marketing tool, assuming the series continues. That's a very clever way. I mean, talk about product placement. It's like...
it's interesting. Just this morning, I was looking online. The show has set up a website for the fake record label that Tom supposedly works for on the show, which is called True Vinyl Records. And if you go to their website, you know, it's presented as if it was the website of this record label, as if it actually existed. And it has all the artists, which are presumably real bands who will, you know, appear on the show in the future as the kind of fake True Vinyl artists. So, for example, Teddy Geiger's on the website, but on the website he's called Wayne. And at a certain point, it becomes like a bit of a hall of mirrors. And I, you know, you wonder if the... if even a viewer at home who likes the music and wants to find out more about it is going to get confused and be like, well, wait, is this guy's name Wayne? Who is this kid? But, I mean, I guess ultimately the point is to get people to hear the music, and that part of it will certainly work. So.
Right, although it's get people to hear the Sony music, it seems. I mean, is this, as far as you can tell, is there any kind of exclusivity, either contractually or just implicit, in the arrangement between Sony and CBS?
I know... Sony and CBS do have a deal to sort of do this on an ongoing basis throughout the show. The show also features music, as far as I can tell, from other bands, from other labels. And Nick Harcourt, the music director for KCRW and sort of very influential in breaking new bands, is a producer of the show and is working as a consultant. and is helping them pick music for the different scenes and stuff. So on the one hand, I think they'll actually be actively putting bands out there who appear as bands on the show, but they'll also be doing the sort of OC model of just playing songs in the background of different scenes. And if you like the music, you can go to their website and find out who the bands are. And I'm sure, you know, in the future we can look forward to Love Monkey compilation albums if the show actually takes off.
All right, Adam, a final question, and it's the big one. Do you think the show will take off?
I think the show is very charming on a lot of levels. I think it has an inherent problem, which it's going to have to work out, which is how do you do a show that's all about being indie credible, where, you know, in essence, you've got a network and a big label behind the show. Are you going to be able to win over the very fans who Tom is supposed to represent, the people who are, you know, want to find that genuine band that's not being foisted on them?
Right. All right. Well, it's a big question. We've been speaking with Adam Sternberg, senior editor for New York Magazine, about the CBS sitcom Love Monkey, which the first couple of episodes have starred this rocker, Teddy Geiger, who's getting a big boost early in his career as the character Wayne on the CBS sitcom. Adam, thank you for joining us on
Thanks.
Soundcheck.
Thank you.
All right, well, as long as we're talking about product placement and merchandising, we'll talk about Mozart in a moment. We'll look at how the composer's name appears on many products. And later, the Four Bags play their jazz-inflected versions of Mozart live in our studio. Sometimes I forget whether we're celebrating Mozart or Falco. The Austrian rapper is getting a lot of airplay this week here at WNYC with his song Rock Me Amadeus, big hit back in the 80s. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and actually we are celebrating Mozart this week, Mozart 250. And apparently, slapping Mozart's name on your merchandise just might make you millions. His name has been used to sell just about everything. There's Mozart beer, Mozart yogurt. Pass me a slice of that Mozart sausage, please. The commercialization of Mozart's name has brought his legacy to the mainstream, but has it gone too far? Joining me in our studio is Jim Beckerman, an entertainment writer for The Record of Hackensack. And in a few minutes, we'll be speaking to Bernard Garbusiuk, whose great-great-grandfather claimed to have invented the original Mozart Kugel, a candy that dates back to 1890. But first, Jim Beckerman, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
So your article is called The Thing About Mozart. What is the thing? Why is he so marketable?
I was thinking about this. There are probably three things that occur to me. One is that with any kind of marketing and branding, you try and create an emotional connection with a product. I mean, the advertisers spend countless amounts, you know, millions of dollars trying to figure out how to sell a product to people and to create an emotional association with the product. Mozart, I think, already has an emotional association. I think people think of him as delightful. I think they think of him as joyful. They think of him as fun. They think of him as happy. And that is a very good way to sell candy, to sell wine, to sell sausage, to sell all kinds of things. So I think it's a very – I think it's already sort of pre-sold in
okay.
that way. And I think that's one reason.
Is most of this – I should maybe yeah. – is most of this happening in Austria, in Central
Europe? A lot of
Europe?
It seems to be. But for instance, those Mozart candies that we were talking about, I mean, you can go into any upscale candy store and you'll see – they call them Mozart balls, you know, the little candies, little marzipan candies with the portrait of Mozart. So anyway, that's one thing is the emotional association. The other thing is the child prodigy thing, which is always people love a child prodigy, and they're very excited about that. And the third thing
really,
that occurred
I thought kids,
to me,
well, I thought people wanted to smack child prodigies.
Well, that's they do too, of course, naturally. I mean, when I was – I mean, certainly – I remember when I was taking piano lessons when I was 6 or 7, I got a little book of Mozart sonatinas, and – the opening of it, there was like a 5 or 6 page essay describing how Mozart was this wonderful child prodigy, and by 5 he was writing compositions, by 9 he was writing symphonies, he was playing for the Empress. So I absolutely hated him, of course.
Of course.
And I sort of grew out of that.
But why, you know, why don't we have Bach beer or, you know, Janáček yogurt? What Mozart seems to have something different from virtually any other classical composer.
Well, my my cousin Michael Beckerman is actually an expert on Janáček, so you could ask him. He's written several books. But
I believe we've had Michael here, in fact.
Really?
Yes, a couple of years ago. Yeah.
I think that the other thing I was going to say is that I think part of the appeal of Mozart, and I think a lot of this post the movie Amadeus, is I think this image has been created of him as this kind of guy with the superhuman talent who nevertheless had these very human problems. He was beset by money problems, and he had this wife who didn't supposedly understand him, although that's questionable.
Right.
And it occurred to me that's almost the same formula as Spider-Man. That's like, you know, he's like a somebody with superpowers but with feet of clay. And that's a real pop culture concept. It's very marketable.
Okay. How marketable is he? How much money is out there in the Mozart industry?
I am told something like $6.5 billion in Mozart.
Billion with a B.
Billion with a B. Mozart merchandise. And I guess that includes, of course, the big part of the merchandise is, of course, the music itself. And that's all the opera productions and all the
right.
concerts and all the CDs and all that. But, you know, also these other products as well.
Well, what are some of those? I mean, just off the top of your head.
The top of my head. Okay. Well, we talked about the Mozart Kugel, which is everywhere.
Yeah, we'll talk with Bernard Garbusiuk about that in a moment.
There is, as you mentioned, a Mozart sausage that was created by an Austrian sausage maker. Apparently, he got the idea in a dream. There is a Mozart tort, which has been billed as a symphony of tastes. There are, of course, Mozart mugs, Mozart T-shirts. There are, just going back to the movie Amadeus, there were all these rock music spinoffs. There was the Rock Me Amadeus, which you just played. There was Elton John appearing on his video in a Mozart wig, followed by Biz Markie appearing in a rap video in a Mozart wig.
So what's the, I mean, where do you find all this stuff? Is it, can you go to an American supermarket and find Mozart Wurst?
Not as far as I know. I mean, I haven't really taken an informed survey of all this. I know you can go to any candy store, any upscale candy store, and you will find those Mozart candies.
Right.
And they're packaged in all kinds of, like, I got one the other day. It's packaged in a little magic flute. You open the flute. And
very good.
Yeah.
All right. Let's bring in Bernard Garbusiuk. Bernard, I hope I'm saying your name correctly.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody, and to your listeners. And it's kind of scary to listen to you. I feel like I'm exploiting, just like everybody else here.
but
horror story.
But actually, Bernard, it seems like what you're doing is carrying on a very old tradition as the owner of Berm's Candies, a family-run business that dates back to the 19th century. Your great-great-grandfather claimed to have invented the Mozart Kugel. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What is a Mozart Kugel?
It's a concoction, and I think the important part, what I think is different to some of the existing confection, is the combination of and the arrangement of this product. So my cousin, and I have to decipher this for you very quickly, I am a descendant of the original Mozart Kugel makers, but I am a candy manufacturer and a chocolatier in the state of Washington who makes a different version. One of this little bit frowned on inspired imitations. I think we make a wonderful imitation. I think it's better than the original one, but I would not tell this to my cousin and not to my forefathers. The original Mozart Kugel in Salzburg is created by having a center of like a pasted pistachio,
uh-huh.
a green pistachio center, and then you surround this with a layer of hazelnut ganache, what is like, you know, infused with a little bit of whipping cream to make it soft and rich, and then you dip it in dark chocolate. And you layer this rather than combining it. So the uniqueness with this confection would be if you, let's say you take lasagna, and you take noodles and the fillings and you smash it together, then it still tastes like lasagna, but it doesn't give you the mouthfeel and the sensation to unmask this thing layer by layer because it goes from the inside out.
Right.
And, that makes one of the specialty.
Okay, so that's the echt, the classic Mozart Kugel?
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
Now, what are you making there in
we
Washington?
We cheat on the... My good, this is not good to see this on radio, is it? We cheat with... we're taking almond paste, and we put just a dash of rose oil with it, and we tint it green. So we bypass the pistachio part. There's reasons for this commercial... commercially, they're harder to get, and also infestations, et cetera, et cetera. Pistachios are a little more like a stepchild in the United States, so it's easier for us to deal with almond paste. But probably like more common in most confections. My cousin, Norbert, he does use the original paste from sweetened green pistachios.
Okay. We actually have a link to Bernard's version of the Mozart Kugel on our website at WNYC.org. And we are speaking with both Jim Beckerman, entertainment writer for The Record of Hackensack in New Jersey, and with Bernard Garbusiuk, the owner of Berm's Candies here in the States, the makers of Mozart Kugel. Bernard, did your great-great-grandfather, I mean, I'm sure I'm in the realm of family legend here, but did he love Mozart's music? Was there some inspiration from Mozart's music that is reflected in the Kugel?
I think so, yes, very much so. Now, I'm not a scholar or an intellectual who, you know, studied the Mozart, but I do know that he fell a little bit already in the last couple of years of his life, and then he fell a little bit out of fame. And it was just about the 100th birthday when my great-great-grandfather in 1890 created this confection because it became more popular again. People liked the uniqueness of Mozart. And, of course, Mozart was always closer to the Salzburg people than to the Viennese people because Vienna was more the residence of the emperor, of the rulers of this country, and Mozart was more dictated to go there, and also that's how he made his money. But Salzburg people kind of embraced him as their own son. And so my great-great-grandfather, for this hundreds years of celebration, actually what they do is celebrate death, but basically he passed away, I think,
right,
in 1791.
Right, a commemoration of his death.
And then for years it lingered, probably, and obviously I'm pretty old, but not that old, so... It lingered for a number of years till it was 1905 at an exhibition in Paris where he introduced this confection, and then it became world famous. And I think, again, the uniqueness is the simplicity. You know, first chocolates or first, not chocolates, but first candies were made from honey and nut meats.
Mm-hmm.
So there we again. He took something very simple, and he took the basic ingredients, not something too exotic, and created such a tasty confection. A little bit maybe like Mozart putting simple notes into such unmatched, beautiful masterpieces.
Yeah, or taking a simple German contradance and making an art form out of it, which
Correct.
Is something that Mozart did.
Yes.
We will continue our conversation. We're speaking with Bernard Garbusiuk, whose Berm Candies makes Mozart Kugel here in the States, and with Jim Beckerman, who's been writing about the marketing and merchandising of Mozart for The Record of Hackensack. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Mozart 250 is our week-long celebration of Mozart, the music, of course, but also the man and the marketing on this edition of Soundcheck. Let me bring Jim Beckerman back into the conversation. Jim, Bernard has been telling us about, you know, his great-grandfather taking sort of standard, you know, ingredients, making something kind of new and I suppose kind of classy out of them by affixing the name of Mozart, mm-hmm. you know, on the anniversary, 100-year anniversary of Mozart's death. As far as you can tell, how far back does the marketing of Mozart go? Can we look at Bernard's great-grandfather and say he might have been the first?
I don't know. I think scholars that I talk to seem to feel that Mozart's widow, Constanze Mozart, actually spent, I mean, she lived about 50 years after Mozart, and she spent a great deal of time boosting her husband, and she got a lot of his works published. I guess her second husband wrote a biography of Mozart to which she contributed heavily. So she sort of got the ball rolling with that. And I think, you know, by the 1830s or 40s, there was the Mozarteum Orchestra had been established. That was also around the 1830s or 40s was about the time, I think wasn't that time Pushkin wrote his Mozart and Salieri play?
The verse play. And then the opera that was made.
And
that
was the Rimsky-Korsakov opera.
Right.
So, whatever Mozart's situation when he died, you know, to whatever extent he was supposedly forgotten, which I don't think he was, certainly by the beginning of the 19th century, he was very much remembered.
Okay. How much of the economy of a small town like Salzburg is being driven by this Mozart merchandising?
Well, if Salzburg didn't have Mozart, they would certainly have the Sound of Music, which seems to be the other thing that tourists go there for. I mean, I can say just my own experience when I went to Salzburg. I mean, Mozart was absolutely everywhere. I mean, there was the candies and the mugs and the beer steins. I was in a little hotel where the statue of Papageno was in
from
the
Magic Square. Flute.
The Magic Flute was in front of the hotel. There were Mozart concerts everywhere. The other thing I remember about Salzburg was seeing chalked in the pavement with white chalk. Somebody wrote, "Tourists are terrorists."
Hmm.
And I noticed that they wrote it in English. So
I wonder how long that remained there before somebody came along and hosed it down.
But apparently there are some mixed feelings in that town about sort of the tourist industry that Mozart, I think, more than anything else, has brought in.
Bernard, is that where your family is originally from Salzburg?
Salzburg in Vienna.
Okay.
And I listened in, and I kind of agree, and I tried to take my turn here, but I do also believe this is extremely overload on Mozart, not only in the past in Salzburg, but now even on the 250th anniversary. It gets to be a little bit of an overkill, but it's a reality of the life. My pastry shop, or my family's pastry shop at the Brotgasse 13, is across the street from the Tomaselli, one of the oldest cafe houses, you know, in the center of Europe. You walk 300 feet further, and you go through where then the market starts, and you pass through a hallway area there, and there's another small, very, very small shop from my family with a Mozartkugel. Then you go outside, and I have with my cousin Norbert a beer in front of the birth house of Mozart. So there are the realities as well as the abuse to this core, and it can get a little bit mind-boggling.
Yeah.
As you said, there's soap out there, there's yogurt out there, and, you know, in my personal mind, I shouldn't want to pick on anybody, but I have no clue how you're going to connect yogurt other than with the marketing and the expectation of making some good money with a good story. But I don't know where yogurt and Mozart would come together so naturally.
Now, so do you think it's, do you think it's unfortunate that most of the general non-classical concert-going public knows Mozart by name rather than by actual pieces of music?
Are you asking me this question?
Well, yeah,
I'll
throw it to you first.
I mean, I'm a music fan, and I buy very strange music. My staff members will attest to that. I buy concert music and rap together. There are some great productions in Europe with this kind of stuff. So I'm older, but I listen to really like a wide variety. But how do you deal with Mozart? Today he would be a superstar who would be a rapper, a country artist, a pop, an opera. He would be all of this in the same time to an extent, but it's unbelievable because he can do all of it masterful. And I think, again, going back to my great grandfather, probably this time and this era needed people to come back out who highlight elegance, but something natural and unique and avant-garde and rebellious.
Mm-hmm.
I think Mozart creates all of these feelings in you.
And Jim, I mean, same question to you. I guess the oversaturation of the market, it risks making Mozart seem like something kind of fluffy and superficial.
One thing that occurred to me when I was writing this article was that in terms for all the flogging of Mozart as a brand, I'm not sure how popular his actual music is with the ordinary person. When you if you ask the man on the street who does not go to concerts, I mean, anybody who's a concert goer knows, you know, the Jupiter Symphony
and
Magic Flute and all that. If you ask the average person in the street to, you know, do you recognize this tune or can you whistle a Mozart tune, they would probably know Ina Klein and Nach music, maybe. I don't know if they would know very much else. And I think that's not – I mean, if you ask them about Beethoven, they probably would know the opening to the Fifth Symphony. They would probably know the Ode to Joy. They would probably know the Moonlight Sonata. If you ask them Tchaikovsky, they would probably know the Nutcracker and the 1812 Overture and a lot of things like that. Mozart is his actual – the popularity of his music I don't think has anything to do with the – I mean, I think people like his music, and I think certainly concert goers like it. And it's associated with things that are delightful. But in terms of actually, I can't think of a Mozart song that was turned into a pop hit.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really, it's interesting that leads us neatly into a little snippet from our show this weekend called Studio 360, in which we ask people about their relationships to Mozart's music. And so we'll use this clip to conclude the segment. It's the marketing director for a concert hall here in the Northeast who, for reasons that will become obvious, requested to remain anonymous, giving us his sort of marketing point of view on Mozart's music. And so we'll listen to this to wrap up. But first, let me say thank you to both of our guests, Jim Beckerman, writer for the Record of Hackensack. Jim, thank you for being here in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
And Bernard Garbusiuk, the candy maker, owner of the family business Berms Candies, makers of the Mozart Kugel for well over a century now. Bernard, thank you for joining us today as well.
Thank you for having me, and good luck with your show.
Thank you. And here is this clip from Studio 360.
Well, I know it's sort of blasphemy to not like Mozart, and especially in my job. And Mozart is so very popular. I mean, he's pretty much the Walmart of composers. You can't get away from him. He's ubiquitous. And I find myself being in programming meetings, and have over the last decade or so that I've done this, and suggesting, because I'm the marketing guy, suggesting that we add Mozart to a program to balance off maybe a lesser-known work or a brand-new piece. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, nuts. You know, I'm the one suggesting Mozart, hoping that it gets on this program, when actually I don't find his music all that interesting. You know, the guy died when he was 35. A lot of the music that we listen to from him was written at a very young age, and sometimes it sounds like it to me.
Well, if you want to hear more personal stories about people's relationships to the music of Mozart, tune in to Studio 360 this weekend, Saturday at 10 a.m. on 93.9 and Sunday at 7 p.m. on AM 820. Coming up, the Four Bags give us a live performance of Mozart using instruments like trombone and accordion. So stay with us and send us your emails, soundcheck@wnyc.org. Thanks for listening to today's podcast of Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.